how did you first meet Elon Musk, and what were the early days of SpaceX really like for you?
Yeah, so Elon called me out of the blue in 2001. It was July on a Friday afternoon, and I was driving home from work, getting ready for a nice long weekend in northern Utah, where the summers are really nice. And at the top down on the car, and the phone rings, and it was a Palo Alto area code, and I'd lived there, so I thought maybe it was somebody I knew. So I opened the phone. It was a old Motorola StarTAC, and answered it. And this strange accent, you know, it was not UK. It was somewhere in the colonies. I wasn't really sure. And he started talking about, you know, how he wanted to make humanity a multiplanetary species. Hello, my name is Elon Musk, I thought he said. He just went on this long discussion about how, you know, he wants to make humanity multiplanetary, how he wants to get it off its addiction to fossil fuels and stop tyrants from controlling free speech, all in like two sentences. And so I said, well, why are you calling me? And he says, well, I need to buy Russian rockets to do this Mars mission. And I'm told you're the guy that can help me. And oddly enough, that was true. So I said, listen, I'm on my way home. I got the top down on the car. I'll call you when I get home. He said, fine. So I got home. I called the number back, and it was a fax machine. So in today's world, you don't hear faxes too much, but it's this high-pitched squealing sound. And I got that when I called back. So I thought, you know, an internet entrepreneur that uses a fax machine as a phone, a little eccentric. So he called me back about 20 minutes later from a different number, which was his mobile phone. And he was very upset. And they said, he didn't call me back. And I explained, you know, about the fax machine. And he said, well, oh, yeah, I don't want people necessarily know my number. This is my mobile. And he said, you know, where are you? And I said, Logan, Utah. He said, do you have an airport? I said, yeah, I can see it from my front porch. And he said, well, I'll be there tomorrow. I've got a private plane. I'll come to your house. And I'm thinking, no, you're not coming to my house. I didn't know who he was, right? And in the 20 minutes between when he called and the first time and when he called back the second time, I got on the internet and started searching the name Elon Musk. I couldn't find anything. So I didn't know who this guy was. So I lied and I said, listen, I'll meet you in the airport of Salt Lake City. And this was before 9/11. And you could actually just walk behind the security. And I knew he couldn't pack a weapon and there'd be police nearby. So that was why I chose that. And so we met in a Delta Airlines conference room. So that was my first meeting with Elon.
And then what happened after that? When you went to Russia, what was your experience like with Elon Musk in the with the Russians?
I'd spent something like 6 years off and on in Russia prior to this. You know, one of my first jobs was in Toulouse, France, with the French Space Agency, and it was a mission to Mars, a French Soviet mission to Mars. So I'd, you know, been through the Soviet Union. In fact, I was there during the putsch in 1991. And afterwards, when I came back to the U.S., had spent a lot of time on behalf of the U.S. government and also Russia. So, you know, the Russians are the Russians, and you still see it today, right? They, I'll just say they're not as evil as everybody seems to think, but, you know, they definitely look out after their own interests. So back then it was no different. And so we did several trips over there, three as I recall. And first one was just sort of reconnaissance, if you will. And Adele Ressy went with us, which was his college friend. And Adele was involved in this early idea of sending mice to Mars. That evolved actually into sending a plant to land on Mars. And that's what we were discussing with the Russians then. And so the early idea was to have this group called Lavochkin build it and fly it. And that was kind of one way to do it. We just provide money and management. And that was a model that we proved out at the Planetary Society with something called Cosmos One. And the second you know, the second idea was to build the land ourselves. But, you know, Lavochkin had done the Venus, like the Venus mission that just re-entered. They built that years ago. So they'd done most of the Soviets' interplanetary missions. So that one was a good trip. And that's the famous image of the three of us in the Lavochkin dining room that's in Isaacson's book. And then we did two more later, the last one being to actually buy the launch vehicles. We'd settled on a mission plan. We'd build it in the U.S. We'd launch it out of Russia, and it would go on a converted ICBM. So we ended up talking to two different design bureaus, as they called them, not companies. And one had built these ICBMs for the Cold War. And that's where we got spit on by the chief designer and basically ushered out. It was a very Soviet-esque, even, you know, 10 years after the Soviet Union, it was very Soviet-style management and so on. And then the second one we went and saw the next day was Kosmotras, and they were a little more westernized. They'd been schooled by the Thiokol people, who are now, I guess, Northrop Grumman, that built the shuttle boosters. They had a business deal with them, so they were a bit schooled in the Western way. They were a little smoother, but still, like, they didn't know I spoke Russian, and they referred to Elon as Malchik, which is child, little boy, in Russian. And so just a lot of disrespect to the man. And, you know, we walked out of that meeting, and Mike Griffin was with us, by the way. Mike later became the NASA administrator. And when we got on the plane to go back to New York, as Mike and I were celebrating takeoff with, I remember, whiskey, Elon turns around to us and says, "Hey, think we can build the rocket ourselves." And we'd had just enough to drink to start making fun of this, and you know, a lot of expletives back and forth, and, you know, saying that, "Hey, there's a whole graveyard of dead bodies you'll have to walk over." And Elon hands us this computer. He says, "Look, I've got a spreadsheet." And Mike and I started looking at it, and it was a model of what became the Falcon 1. And we started looking at it. We said, "You know, where'd you get this?" And so it turns out the same team that had been working on the Mars lander, they also were sort of amateur rocket people, that, and some of them professional, that were building like McDonnell Douglas's Delta rockets and so on, that they'd been, you know, working with Elon on this model. So, you know, he said, "We're going to build this ourselves." And that's how SpaceX started.
Yeah. And what lessons did you take from SpaceX, and like, both what things did you emulate from them, and also what things are you trying to avoid that SpaceX do when building Phantom Space?
That's a great question, actually. So, you know, what do we learn from SpaceX? You actually learn more from your failures than you do your successes. But I consider I had both failures and successes at SpaceX. But the success part was, you know, not really having a limit on what you dream. And a lot of people make the mistake of, you know, thinking, "Oh, that can't be done," and they talk themselves out of something. You know, almost all great endeavors, SpaceX included, starts with an audacious dream. And so you really have to, you know, convince yourself and be comfortable with dreaming audaciously. And that's not something that comes easy to a lot of people, because, you know, in my case, I had a family, young family of four children and a crazy wife. And, you know, here I was taking them on this airplane ride, and I was the pilot, and I didn't necessarily know how to fly the plane, you know? So you take huge risks doing something like that, but, you know, that's how great things are done. And, the second thing I learned from it was that you can do really big things with small teams. So our original SpaceX team was very, very small. I mean, I remember the first year that I was there, we were less than 10 people. And we just sort of did whatever needed to be done. And, you know, I, for example, did a little bit of engineering. I did a little bit of market analysis. I did a little bit of sales, and I did contract management. So I just did what needed to be done. And that was true of everybody in the company. And you can really move mountains with small, motivated teams of people. And then, you know, as far as my own personal failure with it, I left very early, and I don't necessarily view this as a failure, but it's a lesson, right? It's probably a financial failure. I left fairly early because I didn't actually believe that Elon could raise the money to do this. So if you go back to 2001, 2002, Elon had been fired from PayPal and Peter Thiel fired him. And it's amazing that they get along now, but, you know, nobody wanted to invest in this. It was not like today where you get, you know, Elon holds his hand out and 10 minutes later, there's $1 billion. It was not like that. And he had his own money. He had about $100 million that he put into this. And I knew that wasn't enough to do what he wanted to do. And it became clear, by the way, early on, we wanted to do these small rockets, build lots of them, build satellites to go on top of it, i.e. Starlink, and fly that out. But it became clear it was about Mars. And I knew that was billions and billions and billions of dollars. It just was because of the scale of what you have to do, sending humans to Mars. So, you know, not believing that we can actually raise that kind of money was actually a real mistake on my part, because Elon finally found Steve Jurvetson and a few others, and the Google founders also gave him money, but these were needles in the haystack, as we call it. And so in terms of how that, you know, applies to Phantom, you know, we're a very, very small team, and we've got about 20 people, and by the time we get our launch vehicle's going, we'll be about 50, maybe 100, but probably closer to 50. And that's about the size of the team we had at SpaceX when the Falcon 1 was flying. So, you know, a lot of these other companies that are rocket startups, and we do more than rockets, but, you know, if you want to think of it just that way, a lot of these guys, you know, have teams of hundreds and thousands and raise, you know, billions of dollars, and you don't need to do that. And, you know, we did Falcon 1 for $100 million roughly in today's money. And, you know, you don't have to spend that kind of money to get this done. So there's a pathway there. The other part that I took away from it, and, we like to say we employ the SpaceX playbook because, you know, we were part of writing it. And when I say we, there's four early SpaceX, people at Phantom. But the idea of having your own launch vehicle is really very strategic, and it allows you to deploy your own constellations and do your own missions, if you will, at your internal costs and at your own internal priority, which means you can dominate schedule. For example, Starlink uses 75% of the capacity of Falcon 9, meaning 75% of the launches are used for Starlink. So that will continue with Starship, I believe, because they have an even higher number of satellites they want to launch. And so this is the real key of SpaceX and why it's so wildly popular among investors.
Yeah. And you've mentioned the importance of satellites and kind of how SpaceX is almost using satellites to fuel and to kind of raise money for their Mars missions. What's the role of satellites in Phantom Space? How important are they for your new company?
Yeah, so very important. We think of Phantom as being the Henry Ford of space. And if you go back 100+ years when Henry Ford conceived of the Model T, his idea was to build cars for 95% of the world instead of 5%, which was sort of what the early automotive industry was. The cars were a plaything for the rich. They were very expensive. You had to have a driver that was specially trained to operate them. And Henry Ford comes along and says, hey, I'm going to build a car that the average person can afford and they can have parked in front of their home. And that was revolution at a time when people really thought they needed horses. So we want to do the same thing for space. And to do that, we have to take space from what it is today, this legacy from nation state domination of these high capex, very expensive, slow to produce space assets to something that's digital. So like right now, you know, you're halfway across the world and I'm speaking to you electronically. The world is digital. and commerce is digital and everything works at the speed of digital, except in space. It's still that slow old economy. So at Phantom, we wanted to transform the space industry to something that's digital. And what that looks like is a set of satellites that we call Phantom Cloud that do three things. One, they give access to satellite data that's flowing out of space. If you think of satellites in space that are taking images of Earth, that are communicating, that are, you know, measuring weather, all these data, that data is growing so fast, and eventually it's going to get to the point we can't get it back to the Earth. So we need to process that data with AI. And so we want to take that data that's backwards compatible for all the satellites that are already up there, be able to, you know, transmit that on our mesh network in space with edge computing so that you can reduce that data back to the end users. Second part of what we want to do is to put data centers on orbit. And that'll allow then large scale access both from the terrestrial data centers. It can be, you know, another layer, if you will. If you think of New York City, you know, the real estate's vertical as well as horizontal. So we want to create that vertical real estate in the data center space. And you can create some unique security capabilities there and then hook that into the satellite data, which can then have space-based access to those data centers and much more powerful AI capabilities. And then the third thing it does is, and this is what I'm most excited about, is it creates an app culture in space. So an app store that you can, you or I or, you know, our children or our friends could go and go into an internet portal and use AI to generate some code to, say, utilize certain, you know, image data of the Earth and so on, and create apps and create value from that, much like we see on our mobile phones. So that's the ultimate goal of Phantom Cloud. We think the market is, I won't say infinite, but it's enormous. It's disruption of a traditionally very government-centric industry that's just ripe for the disruption. And so that's our ultimate goal of the company. We need a launch vehicle to do it. So that's why we're building the Daytona vehicle, which I think is right sized for this. And we've been, you know, a little bit like the character played by Robert Duvall in Apocalypse Now, where he's standing on the beach and the mortars are coming in, and we're just kind of going, okay, we survived this very bad valley of death that a lot of our peers have died from. But by being frugal and by focusing, we haven't changed our focus one iota. And this is an idea I personally have been thinking about for 20 years. So it's not something I'm easily, you know, taken away from. So the world has come to us, as it turns out, on this. And now people are starting to realize that this is a very formidable idea.
You've mentioned already a few kind of key lessons for space startups just then. And you've been open about previous startup failures during your career. I was just wondering, what's the toughest lesson you've learned, and how do you pick the right co-founders for a space venture? Because I know you've mentioned how previous startups you've kind of disagreed and maybe split with co-founders. So how do you pick the right co-founder, and what traits should you avoid co-founders?
Good question. I'm on my 12th startup, and most of them in space. A few are in electric motors and automotive and software, but it's all the same. And it's all about the founders first and foremost. And you have to be even more close, if you will, than a marriage, strangely as sounds. It is a marriage of different forms. And so you have to be ideologically aligned. You have to be aligned in you know, believing in the ultimate purpose of the company. And you all have to work equally hard. And, you know, in the past where I've had failures, you know, there's two of the 12 haven't gone forward. I was one of the co-founders of one of them. I chose bad co-founders is kind of the way I look at it. We weren't aligned. And then when things got difficult, and they always get difficult, finger pointing started and things came apart. And then our investors decided to bail out. And so, that number one thing is to pick your co-founders very carefully. And it doesn't necessarily have to be somebody you've known, because in this case, I'd known these guys for 20 years. And some of them went back to the early SpaceX days. They weren't SpaceX people. They never joined, but, you know, I knew them for that long and longer. And I didn't know them really until things got bad. And so that's number one. Number two is you have to really continue to have this optimism that what you're doing is going to continue and don't give up. So the other one that I was a part of, Moon Express, you know, it looks like to me in retrospect that, you know, the there was timidity to actually go out and build this. And when they did start building the lunar lander that we were going after, we didn't have a good team. And that eventually sunk the company, and the original founders just didn't have this tenacious, I'm never going to give up sort of attitude, and went on to something else. So they went very far, but, you know, at some point they just gave up. So that was sort of a wounded animal that never recovered. So, you know, all my other startups, at various degrees of success, they've all had a really solid, co-founding team. And you'll see that when investors come along, they'll look at the co-founders and say, is this really the team that could pull it off? And, it just takes something, you know, here in the heart that you truly believe this, you feel like you're on a mission. And, that's where we're at Phantom. You know, we feel like we're on a mission and nobody can deter us from it.
Yeah. Is that what keeps driving you to go forward after all these failures and all these kind of setbacks?
Does. You know, it's not about money. Like, money's important, right? And the investors are in it for money, but we can't drive our, you know, decisions by money. We're on a mission. And mission-driven founders tend to be more successful, in my experience. And so that's why you want to look for people as co-founders who are mission-driven, and we all are. And what's funny is as time's gone on, we have people that come and go, and the non-believers, you know, leave in the hard times. They're like, oh, this is getting too hard, and they go find something else. And I don't know. That's a form of timidity that I hope to never have in my life. And I dig into something and believe in it and stick with it as long as I possibly can. I have my days, you know, when I think, oh, why am I doing this? You know, but this, it can't be about money, because that's a false goal. You know, that's like worshiping a false god, as they say.
Yeah, you have to have the passion. What are ways for space startups to stay frugal? Because I know the space industry is notorious for, or used to be notorious for, having really high prices on things.
Well, so there's a couple of things. First, that the people having, you know, space hardware really it lends itself to experience, because when you make a mistake in space, it tends to be very expensive. And so you want very experienced people, and you know, you don't want all gray hair, but having a lot of gray hair really helps. And this is true of hardware in general compared to software. You know, if it was a software startup, somebody your age is much more suited to it, because, you know, I used to be, in my day, was very good with software. I was, you know, in mechanical engineering, some of the first to learn C and so on. I was way ahead of everybody. I can't program a thing now. My skills atrophied. And so the young people tend to be more inclined to startup, software startups. But, you know, the other thing that you do in space is, and this is true in any startup, is you have to resist this idea that because you have investor money in the bank, you are rich. That is investors' money, and you have to treat it accordingly. And you just have to be crazy frugal, right? Just not spend a thing. So, you know, at Phantom, we're notoriously cheap. And, you know, we'll spend money on the things that need to be spent, but, you know, things we don't need, we just don't. Like, for example, we're here in Tucson, Arizona. It's a little warm this time of the year. And we have, you know, a large manufacturing area, and half of it is not air conditioned. And the other half is, and that's where this time of year we all sit. But, you know, we could put air conditioning in there. It's $500,000 to do it. It's $500,000 that I could spend on something else for now. When we need it, we'll put it in. I always like to say, is you wait to the last second of the last minute of the last hour of the last week or the last month when somebody says they need something. Then you wait another month. And by then, a lot of times people go, oh, we don't need that. And so we save more money that way. It's crazy.
Yeah. Looking ahead 50 years, what sci-fi concept do you think is most likely to become a reality in space?
Well, I think, you know, Mars settlement is probably, you know, something for me in my era was definitely, you know, Ray Bradbury. And so I think that's going to be real. And I think that robots are going to play a much bigger part of that than we think. They always have, by the way. We call, you know, rovers rovers, but they're really robots. And, you know, humanoid kind type robots that do human type work will become more and more common and probably be, you know, sort of the equivalent of what we see in the Middle East with a lot of guest workers that come into the Middle East. And so we'll see a lot of guest workers that are robotic on Mars. I think eventually, this is looking a little further out, we'll figure out some new form of physics that allows us to do interstellar travel. Right now, it's terribly impractical with the technology we have. It just takes us too long. The nearest stars are about 25 light years away, which means, yeah, it takes 25 years going at the speed of light. We're going to have to understand physics in a different way to do that. And I think that'll happen. I don't know what it'll be, but, you know, people talk about wormholes and things like that. Maybe that's real. Maybe it's not. Seems real. But, you know, we'll have to reinvent physics much in the same way, you know, the splitting of the atom reinvented physics as we knew it. And that'll open up a whole new sort of epic for humanity, which will be fascinating. So the Star Trek side of it, I think that's real. It's just, I'm probably not going to see it in my lifetime, which is a shame.
You never know. You know, the speed of things are going right now. You never know, I guess.
I like your optimism. Yeah.
As a quick reflection, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Calm down. Yeah. Don't take everything so seriously. Be a little more Buddhist and just accept that things are the way they are and work within the way they are. When you're young, you think you can affect certain things that you can't. And so that's what I would tell myself.
Yeah, it's good advice. Very good advice. What's one book that's had a huge impact on your mindset and career? I can see there's lots of books behind you, but if you could choose maybe 1 to 3 books that have had the biggest impact on your life so far.
So this is one that I keep going back to over and over. It's called Illusions by Richard Bach. And he's the same author as Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Very simple book about a man named Don Shimoda, who is a messiah. And he's also an auto mechanic, and he didn't want to be a messiah. And he learned that he was a messiah because he could fix people's lives. And then he finally decided, I quit. I'm done. I don't want to be a messiah anymore. And he walked off the job. And people said, you can't do that. You're the messiah. And so he got in his airplane, and as he says, he left for the simpler world of men and machines. And so it was a story of self-discovery. And then, you know, for him, He was on a mission, and it was trying to discover what his mission in life was. And in the end, it was tragic, but, you know, sort of the sense that, you know, we have something to do in life, and I don't fancy myself a messiah, but, you know, for me, it really allowed me to think about the idea that, you know, we have a mission in life. We're here for a reason, and that, you know, it's up to you to find it and to execute.
I'll add it to the reading list. Sounds fascinating. Jim Cantrell, ladies and gentlemen. Jim, thank you for joining me, spending your precious time on this interview. I hope the audience learned as much as I've done. And hope you have a lot of success with Phantom Space. Do you know when the launch is scheduled? Is it public?
So it's still a floating date, but it looks like the end of 26, early 27.
Okay, I'll keep an eye on it, and hopefully the audience will too.